I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Sixth Move, Hunted Rose by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, and Chris Overstreet with Janice Barlow. Also, I'm pretty sure Megazone had something to do with this one. In fact, I know he did, so I don't know why he's not credited. I should probably fix that. Anyway. Sunday, May 1st, 2405. Worcester Preparatory Institute. Worcester, Massachusetts. Earth. Utna Tenjo beamed into the wedge at noonish, still feeling fresh scrubbed after the quick sonic shower she'd taken aboard the one-hit wonder. She waved gaily to the startled inhabitants of the common area, two freshmen trying to study for their introductory physics final, and trotted off toward the Morgan Hall stairs. Real time-savers, those transporters. Without having to land and drive her back to school from the local spaceport, Corwin would make it home in time for dinner. She let herself into Morgan 412 and was almost ready to burst out with a cheery, "Good morning," for her roommate, when she realized Caitlin was still asleep, and, moreover, that she was not alone. Despite the many incredible things she'd seen in her life, Utrina would never have believed it if anyone had ever told her that she would someday see Juri Arisugawa sleeping in a chair. The sight was so unexpected that Utrina had to pause in removing her jacket and just walk slowly around the uglier of the room's two armchairs, taking it in. Yep, that was Juri, all right. Arms folded, head sunk upon them. She was, Utrina reflected, going to have a wicked crick in her neck when she woke up. Curious. Odder still, Juri was still wearing her Otori Academy Student Council dress uniform, which she'd worn to the previous night's spring formal. Apparently, she hadn't made it home last night, despite the fact that home was across the hall, Morgan 413. Utrina turned and looked at the upper of the two bunk beds. Caitlin was, as usual, more or less hidden in her bedclothes, but one outflung arm revealed that she was wearing her usual tiger-striped pajamas. Closer examination of the visible quarter or so of the girl's face revealed that she was looking a bit tear-streaked. Utrina now felt distinctly uneasy, in addition to surprised and puzzled. As she went to her wardrobe to hang up her jacket, she wondered how long it would be before the suspense would be broken. As it happened, it wasn't long at all. At the sound of the wardrobe's door opening, Juri stirred, then looked up and saw her standing there, jacket in hand, ready to put it on a hanger. "Good morning," said Utrina quietly. "Good morning, Tenjo," Juri replied, disgustingly self-possessed for someone who just woke up in a chair. Utrina looked around with affected furtiveness and asked, "Listen, is there something going on I should make myself scarce for?" Juri's mouth quirked in a small smile. "Utrina Tenjo offering to butt out of something?" she inquired. Utrina felt her cheeks heat up a little. "Yeah, well," she said, feeling a bit awkward. "It's not every day I come home to find you crashed in my armchair, and Kate looks like she's been crying. Naturally, I'm concerned." Juri nodded. "You've a right to be," she allowed. "I was just making a little joke." "Juri Arisugawa making a joke?" Utrina said, mimicking the redhead's inflection. To her surprise, Juri smiled again, a little broader this time. "I suppose," said the redhead dryly, "I earned that." Becoming more serious, she added, "Caitlin and I had an interesting encounter on the way home from Coffee Kingdom last night." "Oh, so that's where you disappeared to," said Utrina. "We had things to discuss, but that's not really at issue." Nodding to indicate she was still listening, Utrina went back to hanging up her jacket. It was new, a gift from Kate's father, and she wanted to make sure it didn't get wrinkled, as she thought it was quite sharp-looking. Part of a dress uniform for the International Police Organization's Space Force, a new Galactic Defense Corps the Elder Hutchins was in the process of putting together. The uniform was his answer to her complaint that, on the eve of the formal, she had nothing to wear. "We were coming across the parking lot," said Jury, "when we happened upon Elizabeth Broadbank." "Mm-hmm," said Utrina. "And what was old Liza up to in the parking lot?" she asked, her tone creeping towards snide. "It appeared," Jury replied levelly, "that she was about to be raped by her date." Utrina fumbled with the hanger and dropped her jacket into a heap on the wardrobe floor. Appalled, she whirled to face Jury, her face pale. "Oh, my God," she whispered. "Kate." "Let's go across the hall," said Jury, "and talk there so we don't disturb her." Utrina agreed, and once they were across the hall, Jury sat down in her desk chair while Utrina perched on the edge of the redhead's bed to listen to her. "Caitlin, I've never seen her that way before," Jury said, and she sounded actually shaken, if she only showed it faintly. She separated them, violently. She drew her sword and put it to the young man's throat, and told him to get out of her sight, which he did, as if the hounds of hell were snapping at his heels, Jury added. "I suppose Liza was her usual gracious self." "Liza," said Jury flatly, "was drunk and utterly ungrateful, but Kate was too angry to notice. As I said, I've never seen her that way before. All the way back here, the rage on her face, I never would have thought her capable of it." "You didn't see her take down Sionji when he first got here," said Utrina, "and he was only trying to kill me." She looked down at the ugly brown carpet. "My God, poor Kate." She glanced up at Jury. "Did she tell you anything?" "We talked through the night. I understand I'm only one of three, aside from her immediate family, who know what happened to her." Utrina nodded. "If you count Zoner and Marty Rose as immediate family, which in that group..." "Exactly," said Jury. "At any rate, I..." Jury looked awkward, another rarity in Utrina's experience. "I did what I could. I'm not very good at comforting people. But eventually she got to sleep, sometime around dawn." She shook her head and sighed tiredly. "Not a good omen." "I'll say." Utrina looked lost in thought for a moment, then seemed to come back to the conversation from a new angle, looking surprised. "Since when did you believe in omens?" "I don't," Jury replied. "It's only a figure of speech." Utrina gave the redhead a curious look. "Jury, is there something I ought to know?" "I'm not sure," said Jury thoughtfully. Now she looked nervous, as if she were determined to show all the moods Utrina thought rarest for her, as she went on, "I think Caitlin and I, we may have the beginnings of a relationship." Utrina looked across the room at her old schoolmate, a very peculiar look on her face. It was the look Utrina Tenjo's face took on when she was trying very hard not to laugh. Laughing out loud would be bad. Jury wouldn't take it in the spirit it was intended. For someone who projected such an air of cool unflappability, the redhead was really very easy to offend. It wasn't easy to hold it back. The look of immense gravity on Jury's face as she spoke, as if she thought she might be giving offense, was just too funny, all things considered. After a few tense seconds, the spasm passed, and Utrina felt safe in relaxing her face and letting it smile, at least. "Jury, that's great," she said. "I hope it works out." Jury gave her a small, relieved smile. "I was a bit worried," she admitted, "that you might object." Utrina cocked an eyebrow. "Object? Me? No way. I think it's terrific. If you've actually got to where you think you can move on, and, well, Kate deserves to have something go right. She shrugged. I just think it's great. She shrugged, feeling a little foolish. Just be careful is all I ask. A number of responses came to Juri's mind, but most of them ran afoul of her truce with Azalin in one way or another. So she simply smiled. Despite everything, as Caitlin's roommate and best friend, Utrina's opinion was important to Juri in this matter. Juri might have been about to comment further, but the rattle of a key in the lock on the door forestalled her. R. Dorothy Wainwright, Juri's roommate, entered, closed the door behind her, then noticed that Juri had company. "Oh," she said. "Good morning, Utrina." Utrina raised an eyebrow. "Just getting home, Dorothy?" Dorothy nodded and went to her wardrobe. She was still wearing the scarlet and black dress she'd worn to the spring formal the night before. It was a bit wrinkled, but didn't look like it had been slept in. "You don't suppose..." "No, that's ridiculous," thought Utrina. "She probably just didn't sleep. It's not like she needs to." "Have I missed anything?" Dorothy asked nonchalantly as she got her bathrobe and some weekend clothes from her wardrobe and drawers. Juri suppressed a laugh. Utrina didn't bother, which drew a mildly quizzical look from the robot girl. Utrina waved it off, and Dorothy, shrugging slightly, went off to shower. Utrina had been surprised to learn that she did that daily. It had seemed to her that, only having to worry about environmental dirt, Dorothy could get away with putting it off, but she never did. She was down in the showers every morning, just like everybody else. With the most urgent part of their conversation finished, Utrina went back to her room to finish changing out of her IPO Space Force uniform, while Juri got her own morning shower underway. Then, more comfortable in Martian Army surplus red battle dress trousers and an Art of Noise t-shirt, she slouched in her ugly armchair and played a three-way game of toss with the two little robots who shared Morgan 412 with her and Caitlin. She knew she should have been studying. Finals started tomorrow. But somehow, after last night, she just couldn't get into an academic groove just yet. Maybe after lunch. She wondered if Kate would wake up before Utrina got hungry enough to eat without her. That question was answered a few moments later, when Kate turned over, sat up, and yawned, stretching and thumping her upraised left fist gently against the ceiling. "Morning," said Utrina. "Morning," Kate replied, blinking her slightly unfocused brown eyes down at her roommate. "When do you... get in." 10-15 minutes ago," Utrina replied. "Listen, Juri was here," she said, her tone serious. "She told me about what you guys ran into last night. Are you okay?" Kate considered the question as she climbed down from her top bunk, found her glasses, and then started rummaging through her drawers for fresh underwear and clothes for the day. Once she had them in hand, she turned to face her roommate, and, to Utrina's surprise, she was smiling. "I'm way better than okay," Kate replied. Utrina blinked. "Well, that's good," she said. "Not what I was expecting, but good." Kate grinned. "It's amazing what a little... sleep will do for your perspective," she replied, and went off to shower. Wakaba Shinohara had grown accustomed to sleeping on the floor. Her body no longer complained about the rather unyielding nature of that surface when she woke up in the morning. The only times she ever felt any discomfort now were when the quilt she put underneath her got bunched up during the night, and part of her, usually an elbow, had wound up rubbing against the rather harsh, industrial carpet for most of the night. As such, she felt distinctly out of place waking up in a bed. Disoriented, she disentangled herself from the covers, sat up, and looked around. This was Institute Hall Room 301, all right, be it ever so cramped and industrial. She just generally didn't see it from this angle. Sayanji? She inquired. Hmm? A somewhat indistinct figure arose from a heap of quilt on the floor at the foot of the bed and regarded her somewhat owlishly. What am I doing in your bed? Asked Wakaba calmly. Until a moment ago, Kyuichi Sayonji replied dryly, sleeping. Wakaba gazed levelly at him for a moment, closed her eyes, counted to Wamach, and tried again. Why am I in your bed? Because you were so tired after the formal, Sayonji replied. I didn't have the heart to make you sleep on the floor. Wakaba thought that over, then shrugged acquiescently and put her fingertips thoughtfully to her forehead. Man, I only remember getting as far as the steps downstairs. Sayonji nodded. That's where you fell asleep. And you, said Wakaba with a wry smile, carried me upstairs and put me to bed. My penance for not convincing you to leave when you started yawning, he replied, returning the smile. Wakaba chuckled, yawned a waking yawn rather than a fading one, and then regarded him, shirtless, tousled, with part of a quilt over his head like a monk's hood, for a few moments with a considering look. Just how long, she inquired, are you going to go on being a gentleman? Sayonji blinked as if surprised by the question. The rest of my life, I hope, he replied. Oh, how boring, said Wakaba. I guess I'll have to look elsewhere then. Sayonji looked quizzical. Oh, come on, Sayonji, said Wakaba irritably. You're not going to make me throw myself at you again, are you? The green-haired duelist shrugged off the quilt, raked his hands back through his hair, and then gave her a serious look. I'm not sure what you're getting at, he told her. Wakaba sighed. All right, we'll do it the hard way then, she said. Look, we've both changed a lot in the last few months, you and I. You're not out of your mind anymore, and I'm not the naive little Pollyanna I used to be, which might be the only favor Akio Ohtori ever did anybody, she added wryly. You held back from taking advantage of me before, when I was young and stupid, and I appreciate that more than I can say, but... She grinned. Now that I know better than to go out with guys like you, I'd like to go out with you. Sayonji regarded her with an interested, thoughtful expression for a few moments. If he'd had a beard, he'd have stroked it contemplatively. At length he said, deadpan, "You're that desperate to get off the floor?" Wakaba's jaw dropped. She stared at him in horrified astonishment that had just begun to turn to anger when she noticed the twinkle in his violet eyes. She couldn't help it. She threw back her head and laughed. A moment later, there was a knock at the door, and the muffled voice of Institute Third's resident advisor said plaintively, "Come on, Shinohara! I can't cover for you if you let the whole block know you're here." "Sorry," said Wakaba, covering her guilty little grin with her fingertips. That afternoon was idyllic as any Sunday afternoon on the eve of final exams can be. Despite the hustle and bustle of the last few weeks, the duelists and their friends actually felt prepared for this round of exams, which, according to Devlin Carter, was a sure sign that at least one of them was going to fail miserably. Despite his doomsaying, they were all relaxed, all confident, all at their ease. They spent the afternoon and evening scattered in little pockets here and there, talking, getting in some last-minute studying, and enjoying the last minutes they would probably have for the next week that weren't taken up with examinations, preparations for examinations, and all too little sleep. At 8 o'clock that evening, Kate was fooling around with a bit of matrix encoding. testing her memory of a few concepts for the morning's computing dynamics final, while Jury sat in one of the armchairs and reread a chapter in her galactic history text, and Dorothy tinkered with a little melody on Kate's piano. Part of Kate's attention was subdivided away from her project, listening to Dorothy play, and after a few minutes it occupied more and more of her consciousness until the project was squeezed out and she turned.
Dorothy?
She said.
"Hmm?"
said Dorothy, pausing and half-turning to face her.
There's something different about your playing tonight, Kate mused. It's freer, maybe. Not as...
She paused, searching for a word that wasn't as potentially insulting as the first one that had come to mind, when Dorothy smiled slightly and supplied that word anyway.
Mechanical?
Well... Kate shrugged a rather Gallic shrug, which brought a quirky smile to the corner of Jury's mouth, though the redhead pretended not to be paying attention. Dorothy's smile broadened a little.
I don't mind, she said. I know my playing has always been overly regimented. I suspect it's because I was programmed to play rather than taught. But I've been working to overcome that handicap and play more... humanly. Your comment indicates I may be succeeding.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Kate replied. Anything in particular you credit with your success?
Dorothy was about to answer when, with a knock, Miki Kaworu let himself in through the not-quite-closed door. He smiled to see everyone. Then, to Caitlin's nearly infinite surprise, he approached the piano bench and, a bit hesitantly, as though he weren't quite convinced he ought to, he leaned down and gave Dorothy Wainwright a quick but by no means perfunctory kiss. When it was finished, he went rather red and smiled sheepishly. Dorothy merely turned to Caitlin and gave her a conspiratorial little grin.
"You were asking me a question?"
she said placidly.
"With the drawn,"
said Kate, still amazed. Jury, looking over the top of her book, arched an eyebrow, reminding Kate of Professor Stuvek, the Institute's now absent Vulcan teacher, and said nothing, though the impressed look she gave Miki made him redden still further. Dorothy's smile remained unchanged as she turned back to the piano and returned to work on her sonata. Miki sat down next to her, quietly consulting at various points. Caitlin, who still looked slightly shell-shocked, shook her head as if she'd just been shown definite proof that the world was flat, and went back to her programming experiment. A few minutes later, Amanda Dessler stopped in. "The Earthman is a consummate weakling," she announced grumpily. "He's gone to bed already."
"Well," said Kate mildly, "it is finals eve."
"Barely," Amanda said, plunking down in the other armchair. "Not even 20-30 hours, and he's in his rack, alone.
Never before the big game, eh, what?"
she added in an eerie impression of Devlin's Lord Peter Wimsey accent. "Whatever that is supposed to mean." The Gamelon propped her elbow on one arm of the chair and braced her chin in her hand, looking disgruntled. From behind the white sheet curtain, separating Utina's bottom bunk from the rest of the room, came the sudden sounds of photon torpedo fire, a tearing crash, howling alarms, and the cries of several very agitated-sounding individuals.
"Tenjo, what in the world are you watching in there?" asked Amanda.
Utina lifted the sheet, looked out with a grin, and said,
"My douche Bortas!"
Amanda stood up.
"Battlecruiser Vengeance?" she blurted. "Where did you get that?"
Utina grinned. "One of Captain Griffin's officers is related to Professor Krolg," she said. "When I visited his ship yesterday, he was really impressed to hear that I beat Krolg in a rose duel. He gave me their house's baldric and a data crystal full of Bortas. How much?
All of it, said Utrina smugly.
All? Even the movies?
And the animated series, Utrina replied.
Amanda raised her one remaining eyebrow, then composed herself and bowed respectfully.
I salute you, she said. Your good fortune is supreme.
Then she smiled and said, Shove over. Which episode is this?
It's the one where these weird aliens steal Science Officer Spock's primary brain, Utrina replied, making room.
And Dr. McCoy has to operate him by remote control? I love that episode.
Amanda's abandonment of the armchair for half of Utrina's bed, the better to watch the old Klingon TV show on the holoproj field at the foot of the bunk, was fortunate. It freed the chair for Wakaba Shinohara, who arrived a few moments later.
Hey, all, she said cheerily, then plunked herself down. Everybody ready for finals tomorrow?
You're a fine one to talk about that, said Juri, but her tone held no heat, only dry amusement. You don't have to take them.
No, but I will anyway, Wakaba said. That way I'll know what it's like when I have to take them for real next year.
Admirable sentiment, said Juri.
I try, Wakaba replied. Is Utrina here?
Watching TV, said Kate, angling a thumb at the sheet-shrouded lower bunk. Wakaba raised herself from the chair, went to the side of the bed, crouched down, and raised the sheet.
Oh, hi, Amanda, she said, unflapped. Wouldn't it be more comfortable to set that thing up on the windowsill? She asked them both collectively.
I was watching it by myself, said Utrina. Didn't want to bother the others. What's up?
Oh, well, I just wanted to warn you ahead of time so you don't freak out or anything. Sionji and I are sort of actually dating this time.
Utrina blinked.
Okay, she said. That's cool. Long as he stays sane, anyway.
I'll try not to derange him too badly, Wakaba replied with a grin.
Anyway, I just thought you ought to know. You know, so if you see us necking or something, you don't think he's attacking me and cut his head off.
I'll try to keep that in mind, said Utrina wryly.
I suppose congratulations are in order, said Juri.
Thanks, said Wakaba, beaming.
My, Dorothy observed, there's a lot of this going around today.
Huh? Said Wakaba. She tired of her catcher's crouch and sat down on the floor next to the bed, turning to face the piano bench.
What do you mean?
Yours is the third new relationship I've heard of, arising in the aftermath of the formal, Dorothy replied. Then she gave Miki a curious look and added, If what you and I have can be considered one.
Miki looked a little bashful as he replied,
I think it can, yes.
Wakaba gave them an astonished look.
No way, she blurted. Not that there's anything wrong with that, you understand, she added, holding up a conciliatory hand. It's just, I never would have thought...
Kate caught Juri's eye and gave her a questioning look. Juri smiled, nodding slightly, and said, It appears it's a good day for ex-student counselors all around. Wakaba gave her a puzzled look, then glanced from her to Kate and back again, and grinned.
Well, I'll be damned, she said.
Hold it, said Utrina, leaning across Amanda, who was taking the whole thing in with a look of silent bemusement. Did I hear that right? Did Dorothy just say she and Miki are...
Yep, said Wakaba.
What a day, Utrina said with a sigh. I'm happy for everybody. What a world, she said, and returned to her place.
Tell me about it. Say, what does Azalin think of this new development, Miki?
I haven't had an opportunity to discuss it with her, he replied primly. But I suspect she'll be quite pleased.
Wakaba turned to his companion. How'd you do it, Dorothy?
Dorothy looked taken aback. For a moment, she thought the auburn-haired duelist was asking for a technical description of the previous evening's activities themselves, which, though interesting and possibly instructional, wasn't really the sort of thing one discussed in a group setting. Then she realized what Wakaba really meant, and replied with an enigmatic smile, "I asked."
"That's it? You asked?"
"That's it. I asked."
Wakaba shook her head.
"You just asked, and he..." "Ha! You really are Kozue's twin brother."
Juri blinked, then raised her emerald eyes to Wakaba's and said with very firmly reined amusement,
"That was extremely cold, Shinohara."
"Sorry," she said, to that and Miki's look of faint offense. "Really, I liked Kozue. We were on our version of the council together. She was my vice president. She's a lot better nowadays."
Wakaba chuckled.
"Actually, she's even a little uptight now. I asked her about it once, and she told me there's nobody more obnoxious about smoking than somebody who quit, which I guess was supposed to be a metaphor. Back in the bad old days, though..."
She shrugged, shaking her head again in wonder. "Man, what a world! Sayonji's nice, Juri's happy, and Miki's easy. What the hell is going on around here?"
Miki reddened again. "I hardly think," he began, but Wakaba forestalled him with a raised palm.
"I'm kidding," she assured him. "Poor Kozue. She's not going to know what to make of you when she sees you again."
She sprawled back on the floor, grinning up at the ceiling, and said, "Well, good luck to all of us."
"Amen," said Kate.
"Anybody know what they're doing for the summer yet?"
"I haven't thought past surviving finals," said Utena.
"Nor I," Amanda concurred.
"I've scheduled my Turing Board examination for the first weekend in June," said Dorothy. "I hope you all will be able to attend, or submit testimonials on my behalf if you can't arrange passage to Turing 3.
"Really, that's great, Dorothy," said Utena. "When did you finally decide to file?"
"This morning," said Dorothy with a smiling, sidelong glance at Miki.
"I'm sure Corwin can get anybody who's needed to Turing, if we can all free up the time," said Kate.
"I'll be there," said Utena.
"I would not miss it," Amanda declared.
"Nor I," said Juri with a smile.
"I'll certainly go," said Miki.
"Your testimony ought to be interesting," said Wakaba with a wicked grin. Miki, to her pleased surprise, didn't get further embarrassed. He just raised an eyebrow at her and grinned back. She decided she was very much enjoying this new dimension of her old schoolmate, who, though nice and of course very cute, had always struck her as a tremendous stiff back in the old days.
"We'll all go, said Caitlin. "All we have to do," she added with a wry grin, "is survive finals."
Janice Barlow, as the resident advisor of Morgan IV, had been personally assigned her responsibilities by Claudia Montaigne herself in a brief meeting at the beginning of the year. She'd been told that her appointment reflected her sterling qualities as a campus citizen, her willingness to go out of her way to help a fellow student, her diligence in her studies, whatever. Her ability to wake up in a good mood before 10 a.m., however, had not been mentioned, and for good reason. It simply didn't exist. Thus, when the sound of repulsor lift engines outside reached her ears at precisely 8:30, she was not pleased.
"Oh, what the hell," she growled, rolling out of bed in a heap of covers and managing an undignified crawl to the window.
She pushed the blanket out of her face long enough to look down, and sighed deeply at the sight of uniformed Psi Corps personnel spilling out of the blocky shape of a Federation-style shuttlecraft, which was parked across the access road that led from Institute Road behind Morgan Hall to the ring road around the quad. They were sealing off the campus, and that meant, though Janice's room was on the wrong side of the building to see it,
They were probably all over the quad, too. I assume this means exams are canceled, she mumbled, sleepily extricating herself from the rest of the sheets and grabbing the nearest available clothing. Shrugging into a well-worn dark gray shirt and black fatigue pants, she ran a brush through her hair and gathered it back into an auburn ponytail. Guess I better try to get over to Miss Montaigne's office. Mitra, where the heck have you gotten to? Come on, you. Muffled sounds of struggle emerged from the heap of blankets on the floor. Janice sighed and carefully pulled them aside to expose the source of the noise. A small creature that looked rather like a chitinous football with a photoreceptor and a small antigrav unit flew out of the chaos and took up a station behind her right shoulder. Janice chuckled and gave the creature a gentle rap on the chitin. You know you're not a dog, right? Then why do you insist on trying to cuddle up at night? It only gets you tangled up in the sheets. She chided gently. Janice gave herself one last once-over in the mirror and shoved her feet into her Regolian colonist's standard-issue boots. Before she could grab her keys and ID and head out, though, her desktop terminal beeped. Not its usual plaintive blat, but a somewhat more urgent chirp. She turned to it with a frown. I'm kind of busy right now, you know, she told it matter-of-factly, smacking a few keys and bringing up the screen. She wasn't terribly surprised to find an email from Durandal, the somewhat erratic campus AI, although at least this time the message was clearly legible. Return path, Durandal at durandal.wpi.k12. Date, Monday, 2nd of May, 2405. 08-31-48-0500-ET. X-Center, Durandal at localhost.localdomain. 2. Janice Barlow, jbarlow at wpi.k12. Subject, Action. Durandal, 1707. Incoming message from Durandal. Your schedule for the week has been cleared. Apparently there's something about the presence of armed troops on campus that makes people unwilling to make plans involving the furtherance of higher education. Imagine that. I trust that you will find some method of bringing yourself, your armament, and your disregard for the toy soldiers outside to Fuller Labs within the next half hour. Yours in disdain for authority, Durandal. Janice looked at the screen and sighed. Pushy bastard, isn't he? She commented, possibly to Mitra, possibly to the air. She took another look out the window, using her cyber-eye to enhance the view. The Psy-cops down there, setting up their barricade, appeared to be a mixture of normal personnel, which were frightening enough even if you weren't psionic yourself, and black-armored enforcers, the iron fist of the Corps. She snapped the eye back to normal magnification. Handy thing to have, but she could have done without the accident involved in getting it, and went to the closet. A moment's concerted tugging and pulling hauled down a battered gray case that was thumbprint locked and impressively labeled with the spray-painted stencil outline. Property of Hunter's Guild, Colony of Ragol, License Number 32343. She pressed her thumb to each of the three latches in turn and punched a quick code into a small keypad under the case's massive handle. The locks sprang open with a brief hiss of releasing pressure. She hadn't had to open this case, aside from her quarterly check on its integrity, since she'd left her homeworld. By contrast, the small gun safe that held the pistol she used in WPI tactical pistol matches was protected by one fingerprint lock and no keypad. The Colony of Ragol took its weapons and their security very seriously, and for a good reason. The original colonists of Ragol, expatriate Corellians to a man, had learned one important lesson during the settlement. The native animals were unusually rambunctious. This wouldn't have been a problem, really, except that this rowdy disposition was backed by immense size, unusual cunning, and prodigious natural weaponry. Faced with this opposition from nature, the new Ragolians had responded in the time-honored tradition of their mother world. They'd gotten to work, building bigger and better tools, both social and mechanical, to handle the problem. Within 3 years of initial landfall, the colonists had pulled together both a flourishing munitions industry, spearheaded by Ragol Arms,
and an officially sanctioned hunter's guild to handle the wildlife problem and take on other missions as needed. Janice had inherited this particular gun, a Raggle Arms Verista, from her father, who had been one of the first proponents of the need for effective, organized action to establish a solid footing against the native flora and fauna. The Verista was a chunky pistol, with a large barrel surmounted by a peculiar cylindrical chamber. The chamber was located behind a laser sight of unusual proportions. It looked like, given the chance, the sight could be just as mean as the actual weapon. The rest of the gun followed a smaller, sleeker version of the blocky barrel styling. She checked the empty chamber carefully. The contacts were clean. She laid it aside carefully and moved on to the armor. Regolians were practical people by nature. Mecha just weren't feasible in the high mountains, deep caves, and dense forests of their new world. They'd chosen to focus their engineering skills on powered armor, exoskeletons that were both powerful and portable. The refinement of that aesthetic had produced the Frame, a series of simple body armors that bore some resemblance to the CVR-5 armor of the Wedge Defense Force. Frames tended to be a bit bulkier, but afforded considerable protection against claws, teeth, and some forms of blaster fire. Janice's particular frame was no different. It was a complex affair, in her favored black and gray, bearing the understated green emblem of the settlement she'd lived in back home. She slapped the panels into place and secured everything, then picked up the small shield projector in the bottom of the empty case and secured it in a small slot on her left wrist. Last of all, she picked up the Verista and slapped open a turnout panel on the leg of her frame with her free hand. The small compartment thus revealed held an assortment of power packs. She loaded one into the gun with practiced ease. It clicked home and emitted a brief sputter of light before settling into a steady blue-green glow. Janice holstered the gun at her hip in one movement. "Gotta love photon technology," she mumbled. "Time to keep that appointment." "And to think," she remarked to herself as she trotted down the hall to the back stairs out of Morgan Hall, "I wanted to leave this stuff at home when I came to Earth."